Now, the person doesn't have to take this on. He can live in the midst of it, but he does not have to become contaminated. There's no law that says that it has been absolutely necessary, inevitable, or irrevocable that an individual has to become an alcoholic. There is no reason given by heaven or earth why an alcoholic has to drive a car under the influence of alcohol. These are things we do ourselves, and our worries are just as futile and useless as these other habits. We have no law that says we have to be frightened. We have no law that says that we have to have a world that does what we please it to do, or otherwise we will be miserable. There is no law that says we have to be happily married or have pleasant relatives or obedient children. These factors do not exist as inevitable necessities. Therefore, we cannot resent or reject the opposite when it comes along. But every one of these relationships has lessons. Everything has something to learn. We are not only indebted to our families for a great deal of valuable knowledge, but our children are indebted to us for inevitable truths. All these things are common necessities of life. We can reject them. We can allow prejudice and criticism and condemnation to destroy all of the integrities of relationships, but this is not because it is necessary. It is because we have chosen to do it that way. We have had our personal conceits rebuked in some way, and we can never forgive the person who did it. Our relatives do not do what we expect them to, therefore we won't speak to them again. It all lies in our own situation. None of the problems that face us in our personal lives can remain completely unchanged if we determine to change them. There are responsibilities which we may not be able to dispose of, but we can transmute them into opportunities. We can do anything we want with the problems of the day if we will place inside of ourselves a measuring rod, a ruler, by means of which we can measure the things that happen in daily life. One of the situations that we all have to face today is unemployment and all of the relations to it. We have to sometimes give up many luxuries that we have come to consider to be indispensable. Many persons are unable to give up anything without falling apart. And yet these same persons, when they pass on, must give up everything and do nothing more than accept the fact. Everything in life can be understood, reevaluated, and accommodated to if we really wish to make the effort. Therefore, if we are good worriers, as most people are these days, we should take some of these worries and see what we can do about them, to see how we can change our own thinking or our own relation to them, and recognize that a problem is a challenge, not a disaster. Now, we cannot always solve a problem, but the moment we come against a problem we can't solve, this is highly educational in itself. The fact that we can't solve some common human problem may just be a proof of that we are not infallible, which is a discouraging discovery to make, because we wish to assume that whatever is necessary, we know it. Whatever we should be doing, we do it. And to suddenly wake up and find that we are not getting anywhere with our own infallibility can be one of the most important lessons that we will ever learn in this world. It suddenly gives us the opportunity to recognize that what we consider to be the proof of our wisdom is merely, perhaps, only the pressure of our own egos determining what we're going to do. So we can begin to find out, for instance, that our advice isn't always good. If our advice isn't good, why? Is it because we've had no opportunity to learn? Is it that our own lives have been so instituted that we are giving advice based entirely upon personal experience? What is the reason why our advice is worthless? Our advice is usually worthless because we have not actually learned any of the lessons of life that would make our advice significant. The individual who has suffered much and come through it can give advice. The individual who has suffered little and is sorry for himself all his life has very little to contribute to human problems. So it's a matter of gradually gaining an integration within yourself. And this integration begins with one basic conviction, that the universe is right. The things that happen, happen because they must happen. And they must happen because the law of cause and effect is immutable. And yet this law never was and never will be a tyrant. The law is not something that is punishing you unjustly or taking away from you things you deserve. The law of cause and effect is reminding you whatever that you want in life that is worthwhile, you have to deserve. You have to earn happiness. You have to earn security, not in the terms of a business venture, but in terms of internal acceptance of value. We all come into this world with nothing. We even have a body that for a long time isn't much help to us. We live a while, 40 years perhaps, if we're lucky, and then we leave this world. And we leave it with nothing at all, except what we have developed within our own consciousness. If there's anything that survives, it's the soul and the inner life enriched by good works and by understanding and insight. Other things are useless. If we die of a broken heart because we can't take physical wealth with us, we are really in a very impoverished condition. And if we leave great wealth to our descendants, we are likely to be doing them a great harm. So nature, in its own quiet way, can give us the securities we need. Let's look around ourselves for a while, and in other people, try to see the consequences of attitudes. Try to see who among the people we know is perhaps the most happy. If we know one individual or two or three individuals who, out of a good lifetime of years and experience, are still strong in faith, who still are able to rise above the emergencies of living, when later years face the future with peace and calm of spirit. What have these people that we do not have? And we generally find out that it is a disposition that is based upon constructive reactions to circumstances. These people are not the ones who never suffered. But these are the persons to whom suffering was a maturing power, not a rotting one. We will also find that most of the people who are happy in this world are satisfied with little, cherish the things that they do enjoy with great quietude, with patience, with understanding, with gratitude. These people are grateful for small mercies. We are ungrateful with great blessings. Therefore, our lives are not as theirs are as the years go on. We can find in this world a great many persons whose conditions are no better than our own, but whose attitudes are remarkably better. And this gives us the realization that ours can be bettered also. We are not born pessimists. We have to train ourselves to be a pessimist. We have to gradually eliminate from our lives everything that is good. And we almost always have to blame someone else for the tragedy, because very few people want to accept the fact that they are wrecking their own lives. So out of a little thoughtfulness comes the possibility of the person gaining a stability in this period of stress, which is the thing we are all much concerned with. And we will find ultimately that no change in our outward circumstances will produce this stability. We can move into a smaller house, it may help. We can move into a larger one, which will gratify certain ambitions and bring with it more responsibilities than we can carry. We can do all kinds of physical things, trying to find that peace that the world is seeking. But it will still be elusive, because everything that is physical is transitory, and the only thing that is not transitory in man is his own soul. And this is the thing which he must educate, he must release into manifestation, and he must serve with fullness of heart and mind. So if you finally decide to do something about it, begin the cultivation of constructive living and thinking. Let the mind be concerned with something that is not worldly. Now, many things have come along that people have found to be very helpful in the steadying of their emotional lives. Service to other people is a tremendously remedying factor. To forget our own needs, our own wishes, our own desires, to help persons less fortunate than ourselves, has one great virtue. It takes our minds off of ourselves. And it is the individual with his mind locked on himself who is in the deepest trouble. Then there are all kinds of constructive attitudes. The individual can begin educating his life. And in most persons, the education of his life will involve and must involve some religious insights. Now, religion is a very personal thing. Religion is a relationship between the individual and the divine power behind and within himself. When it is viewed this way, it is called mysticism. For mysticism is the belief in the immediate possibility of direct contact with the divine. It does not require intermediaries. It does not require that the individual follow the concepts or traditions of other persons. It means that through the natural expression of internal integrities, the individual penetrates into the core of himself and receives virtue and refreshment from that power which lies at the root of his own nature. This means, of course, that the calming of the mind is of the greatest importance. The individual who is constantly agitating his thoughts with negative attitudes is not going to have this calmness. But quietude, which was, of course, the basic religious concept of what were called the Quietists, which included the Friends and the Quakers and a number of Oriental sects, this quietude is an expression of the term, "Be still and know that I am God." Instead of worrying, the stillness helps. Stillness is not an escape from worry. It is an internal realization that there is something deeper, more valuable, more useful, and more beneficial than worrying. It is worrying that is locking us away from our own inner lives. All the criticism and condemnation and irritation, no matter how much we believe it to be deserved, is simply cutting out our own internal experience. The more we fix upon outside problems, the less time and energy we have to release internal strength. So one of the simplest things that the worrier can try to do, if he is so minded, is to take on interests that break in on the worry pattern, doing things that are maybe not important physically, but are very important as release of understanding and insight. The studies of arts and crafts, the experience of doing things with the hands, these are very valuable to the person whose mind is troubled all the time. The individual cannot divide his energies equally on two different levels simultaneously. Therefore, if you can't do anything better when the times get pressureful, just sit back quietly and knit. Anything to use a power to separate the person from negative thinking. If you have to keep your mind on something else, this helps. Poetry is of a good nature, is a great help in these pursuits. A very fine inspirational literature can help. not necessarily of highly advanced intellectual study of the universe, but simply gentle quietude. It's poems that reach into the heart of things. They bring gentle messages of peace and contrition to the tired person. But whatever it is, gradually educate your mind until you are able to tell it, I want you to see the good in things. I want you to observe progress. Now, in seeing the good in things, we do not want the mind to find good in the things that have never been any good. We do not want the mind to go back to its old habits. To see the good in things for the average person is to realize that an experience is meaningful, and that out of the things that happen, we grow, and that a misfortune is not a blight upon us, but a challenge upon our resources. To accept the challenge of growth, we must avoid the tendency to try to escape growth by economic means or by travel or by change, which has no direct bearing upon the facts. If you can achieve a certain amount of peace within your own nature, you can then begin to re-educate yourself. It may take some time because you may not be able to just re-educate everything at once, because you may have to re-educate your background back 3 or 4 generations to get at the root of some of it. Your families have been made up of warriors. Everyone has struggled for something that he either didn't get or lost afterwards, or perhaps even more often got it and no longer wanted it. These things you have to work out in your own life. In childhood, in education, in marriage, in relationship with life, business, children, and everything, we have been taught to be concerned in the sense of being irritated. We have been taught to be critical. We have been taught to dislike rather than accept the major occurrences of existence. We consider change a disaster when no change can be the worst disaster of all. So with these concepts basically working in us, we must try for the beginning of security, and that is a quiet, prospective relationship with life. When something happens that for the last 50 years has caused us to be angry, the best thing to do is to take a deep breath, relax, and keep quiet. Instead of answering back and starting an argument that might go far enough to break a home, just say nothing. Very quietly let the thing die without adding anything to it. Try never to put salt into an open wound. Never try to argue faster or better than somebody else. That is how wars are made. Of people out-arguing each other, nations out-arguing each other, each one certain that its ideas are the best and that the other one is wrong. So under doubt, be still. And in the being of stillness, and in the quietude of a complete detachment, try to understand what is really meant, what is all involved in this entire problem. Who is right? Who is wrong? What is the meaning of the occurrence itself? Little by little, if you do it this way, things become symbols of value instead of symbols of loss. By degrees, the individual can gain great insights from the quiet acceptance of life. He can also observe the consequences that come to people who are not self-controlled. He can see how the argument leads to another tragedy. He can see how people walk out on each other over trivia, and why children leave home and get into difficulties and perhaps ruin their lives. Now, each person in his own way thinks it's somebody else's fault, that these are ungrateful children, that these are children who do not appreciate values and securities. But the person then says, what securities did I give them? Did I give them 3 meals a day, send them to school, and start them off? Did I give them any moral or philosophical insight? Did I simply scold them when they didn't do what I expected them to? Or if they had a fault of some kind, did I punish them? was there anything in my relationship with these children to inspire them to search within themselves for greater values? Did I give them a spiritual foundation of integrities? Did I prove to them through my own conduct that my security was based upon integrity? If all of these, or most of these things, were lacking, the mere fact that we supplied them with all the physical necessities of life still leaves us with a tremendous unmet responsibility. And this is true in almost every walk of life, that we bring people things, but we do not help them to establish foundations that will endure. Today we are looking, perhaps not for some time in the past, for better religious values. All around we are finding new groups of people, and old groups also, that are beginning to come back to faith. Now some of these, in some of these countries where religion is in trouble, particular trouble, the faith itself is a tremendous factor. Even though politically these countries may not be allowed full religious freedoms, they cannot be taken away from the individual's internal life. There is no degree of persecution that can prevent the individual from his internal acceptance of realities. He may not be able to expound them to other people. If he tries to preach them, he may find himself in prison or in worse situation. But there is no reason in the world and no power on earth that can prevent the individual from living on a level of personal integrities. He can do whatever is the unpleasant task, but he can do it with an understanding of why. And that out of persecution, out of all of the difficulties that beset him, he is gaining the strength to stand above all of the problems that he has previously considered insurmountable. So we know that it does work. Another thing that is very important in this problem is to maintain some type of regular religious relationship with life. And most of the time we attribute this to church gathering. We think that the individual should join a church, should attend services, and perhaps send children to the Sunday school. But this is, again, a physical solution to a mystical problem. I think every churchgoer should give great thought to how he acts on the 6 days a week that he doesn't go to church. This is the problem. Is he able to gradually maintain a higher level of religious integrity in his daily happenings? Is he able to live every day of his life some principle that he has learned from his religion? Is he setting an example to other members of his family? Is he doing the things that prove the sincerity of his religious commitment? The commitment that simply is fulfilled by a donation or fulfilled by attendance in public worship is not enough. It is something else entirely. It is the individual's own internal acceptance of a divine principle. Now, unfortunately, most of our principal religions of today do not give adequate training on what constitutes the real objects of religion. Many religions simply tell us that we should fear God. Others that we should love God. But both of these terms are extremely abstract. They're very hard to understand. What we all have to understand every day is that religion, all real religion of every denomination, is a way of conduct. And if the conduct is inconsistent with the creed, the situation is out of order. Therefore, religion in all matters is to have a constructive relationship with life. Religion is the power of the individual to see God or good in the occurrences of his daily existence. It is necessary for the person, if he is truly religious, to become very grateful for the privileges that are given to him in life. Instead of constantly beseeching deity to take from him the proper responsibilities which aren't his own, religion is better a veneration, acceptance, and service of that which is known to be superior. Therefore, gratitude for the divine privileges is more important than fussing over the human emergencies. We are here by a wonderful rule, a law that has gone on for millions of years. We are the product of life that has been unfolding for counted millennia. We are here because we are unfolding a divine spark within ourselves. Every noble, beautiful, and wonderful deed that we perform is part of a release of the eternal God within us. Every bit of complaint locks that God further into darkness. The individual who does not see God in what is happening to him will not find deity at all. And deity is a presence challenging. It is causing the individual to call upon his spiritual resources. If he believes in peace, religion calls upon him to keep the peace. If he believes in integrities, religion demands that he lives them every day. Now, of course, sometimes it appears to be martyrdom. But for the most part, we can still do a great deal more than we have done. And our first emotion in life should not be criticism of other people or criticism of circumstances, but gratitude for the privilege of learning, the privilege of being here to face problems and solve them, the problem and privilege to live above disasters and catastrophes, and finally to recognize the divine power and the infinite love that rules all things. The most critics have just forgotten that deity is love. They have forgotten that the things they don't like are practical evidence of divine love. If the divine spirit was not all-loving as well as all-wise, it would permit individuals to make mistakes on and on through the ages until they completely eliminated themselves. It would enable all that is evil to triumph forever, or that the selfishness and littleness of the human being would become the standard of all relationships. This is not true. Actually, that which loveth most is that which chastiseth, that which finds ways to correct mistakes before they become impossible. So as you start out in the day or in any part of your life with a negative attitude on things, with a kind of a glum look, and with a quite definite certainty that everything is going to the dogs, it is much better to be quiet and try to say, where is the lesson? Where is the truth in this thing? What is it that I can do to make sure that my faith is stronger than the emergencies of living? How can the individual prove to himself that his inner resources can carry him through any emergency that arises in his life? There are no emergencies, really. Sickness, death are not emergencies. That which is an emergency is when an individual makes a bad decision. This is an emergency. It is because he has forgotten the principles upon which his life should be built. All things natural are not emergencies. It is not an emergency that we grow older. It is not an emergency that we have to give up certain privileges and opportunities as years go by. Everything is that as we grow older, we have the right to live according to a longer perspective of experience. We can make decisions that the young have not yet the power to make. But in every part of life, youth, age, all periods, we are living within a pattern of divine purpose. If we can get this thought sort of fixed in our minds, we will not be so given to all the worries and excitements that come along. We are worried today over economics. We always will be and always have been, as long as we worship economics. As long as you make the dollar deity, we are going to be out worshiping the golden calf, and we will be always in trouble. If we make our life built upon achievement in the same sense of ambition, and this ambition causes us to be untrue or unkind or unreasonable, we may attain the ambition and at the same time have a stroke or a coronary, because nature doesn't want it that way. Nature doesn't want the individual to live for ambition alone. He wants the individual to have a little ambition and a great deal of aspiration. This is much better. Aspiration means to become more. Ambition means to accumulate more. And the more we become, the less dependent we become upon accumulation until it is no longer a serious emergency with us. Then there are persons who cannot live or cannot believe they are happy unless they are dominating somebody else. Anyone whom we dominate, we must accept the consequences of our own domination of them. We must take upon ourselves the karma that we have imposed upon other people by trying to live their lives for them. And this is especially true if, in trying to live their lives, we are simply demanding that they accept our mistakes. Little by little, we have to learn all these principles. They add up to a quite kindly, thoughtful relationship. A relationship in which we are here to become more and more aware of the infinite good in which we exist. A good which we are spoiling and despoiling ourselves. A good which we were forbidding to have happen because of the fact of our personal ambitions and attitudes. As long as the individual lives as a rugged individual, he will end up as a ragged individual. There is no other way. As long as we put a career ahead of everything else and consider success in terms of monopolistic achievements, we are breaking the rules. And if we break the rules long enough, the rules will break us. There is no way in which we can do right and fail. There is no way in which we can do wrong and succeed. In this emergency of the 20th century, ultimately the thing that is going to happen, has to happen, is that the Tower of Babel that we ourselves have built is going to fall down. But this does not mean it will carry us to oblivion in one terrible experience. It simply means that the individual will be faced with restoring or reconstructing a world which he has destroyed or devastated by his own false attitudes. Suppose you have been an alcoholic for 20 years and suddenly decide to get over it. Now, it's going to take an awful lot of willpower to do it. It is also going to take considerable personal suffering. And it may be that you'll have to be hospitalized for some time to get rid of the pressure of this destructive habit. Now, a world, so to say, is an alcoholic, and that can be more literal than we might think, because alcoholism is a blight upon the whole surface of the earth. But also, alcoholism is a symbol of a way of life. It is a habit-forming symbol of man's selfishness. It is part of a grand pattern in which everything we have done, everything we have thought about, everything we have lived for, has been dominated by self-interest. It has been dominated not by the law of what we should do, but the law of what we want to do and will do regardless of consequences. The only part about it that's uncomfortable is the consequences. But they are there, and they always will be there, and no one will ever be able to get rid of them. So if we are in a bad habit, if our world for several thousand years has been doing it wrong, this will never for one moment change the fact that it is wrong. There's no possible way in which we can cultivate so many vices that any one or all of them can become virtues. The trouble stays the same. Nothing changes. No matter how much legislation we make, how many rules we make, or how many of our contemporaries make the same mistakes, the mistake is a mistake to infinity. It will never be changed. The only way to get over the mistake is to correct it. Now, with this type of thinking, we can sort of relax a little bit, I think. We can live from day to day trying to be what we were supposed to be. Kindly, well-intentioned, humanitarian persons with as much mutual affection for each other as is possible for those who know very little about each other. But to kindliness and fraternity and cooperation, to a constant searching for something that is truly better, and realizing that the successful life is a life dedicated to service and not dedicated to accumulation. As we go along like that, we can smooth out a lot of this worry, fear, all this hatred, all this struggle, which means people come by the thousands to seek help from physicians, mentalists, psychiatrists, and all types of healers, simply because they cannot live with themselves. They have allowed their personal feelings to make them so sick that they are on the verge of a complete psychological disintegration. Now, there's nothing out of those people except their own minds. If they can change their attitudes and their thinking, they can be just as happy as they are now miserable. They can be much wiser also, because they will discover that the causes of misery are their own mistakes. They stop making the mistakes, they will be happy. Not happy maybe in the sense of riotous living, not happy in the sense of going out and expending fortunes on luxuries, but happy in a quiet, peaceful relationship with self, a happiness which is the happiness of the normal person, regardless of his economic estate, a happiness that comes from good work, from being busy, from doing our share of the world's labor, for doing honest measure for whatever we are remunerated, and doing everything as nearly as we can, as we would like to believe that God wants it done. That we will try always to keep not only the laws of man, but the laws behind the laws, the eternal laws that never change. If we can do this, I think we can find a certain amount of strength over whatever is going to happen. What we are not aware of, we can't plan for exactly. But if everything we know today is swept away, we lose really nothing. Because actually, one moment of the heart stop and we've lost it all anyway. Therefore, nothing of a material nature is permanent. Whether we lose it now or on the deathbed makes very little essential difference. The thing that makes the real difference is whether while we are living, we can use things without abusing them, that we can have or not have, and regardless of our material estate, keep faith with principles upon which the world's survival depends. It's always, therefore, not much use to get all worked up over things. Rather, it is better to prove that we are good Christian people, that we are good religious people, that we are devout in our insights and dedications by living a quiet life and shedding and spreading around us only confidence that whatever person we meet, we will not build up their negative thinking, but will encourage them as far as we can to find the truth behind their own actions. We may not succeed, but at least we will not build up their troubles by adding more negative thinking to theirs. If they have to live only with their own negative thinking, it's bad enough. But if they have to live with a pile of it that we put on them, it's still worse. So the best thing to do is to try always to be peaceful and constructive and find the good in the thing as it is. Find the lesson it is teaching us. Find a way of superior existence which it is pointing to. And that it all accompanied by the very simple fact that the more we serve the ego, the worse off we'll be. But the more we serve the soul that lies within, and which is in the God within us, the more we will come into the peace and happiness of realization and final infinite adjustment to the plan of which we are a part. We find all by peace. We find all by quietude. And we find nothing but trouble by fear. Well, I guess that's all, folks.